Cartwright and Tim both play guitar. You know, when's the last time you had a bass in your hand? And I'm like, well, it's been a minute, but sure, I could do it. And it's like, well, we're going to meet at such and such a time, and here's the address and whatever. And it turned out that Tim had a bass that I could borrow. And did I know who the Oblivions were and the Compulsive Gamblers? And by that point, yeah, I did know, but I wasn't as familiar as I was going to be.
Hey, this is Dennis Black for the Black and Wyatt Records podcast. This time around, sculptor and filmmaker Mike McCarthy is talking with Jeremy Scott and his wife, Lauren G. Lauren's a DJ in the local Memphis music scene, and Jeremy's performed in many Memphis bands, from Raining Sound to Dan Montgomery, to the Subtractions, to the Toy Trucks, to the upcoming new release with the Drip Edges. We're going to kick off the interview with a Toy Truck song called I'm on the Dish, But I Ain't No Rag, on Black and Wyatt Records.
We're good. Hey, welcome to Black and Wyatt. We don't have a snazzy name for this. It's the Black and Wyatt podcast. And I'm here with Jeremy Scott and Lauren G.
Yeah.
You guys are married.
Yes.
Yeah.
Never done that before.
Yeah.
I mean, I've done it before, but.
I had too, actually.
Didn't work out.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
really?
Same.
Okay. All right. Well.
Yeah. They.
And you guys, when did you get married?
Last October.
Okay. All right, and then you took off to Spain, I hear.
Yeah, we went to Spain back in April and took our honeymoon and went to Barcelona and did a nice little day trip over to Menorca. And, yeah, it was great. Absolutely fabulous.
Yeah, amazing city, really.
But you guys have been to Europe before.
I hadn't.
Yeah.
I had, but this is the most I'd actually been able to be a tourist, because previously I'd been touring, which is a whole different scenario. Mm-hmm.
Touring, not tourists. Tourism.
Right, right.
Yeah. Well, so how many times have you toured Europe with bands?
With Raining Sound, we went over twice.
Okay. Dang.
Yeah.
But that was a long time ago.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was thinking about it. It'd been 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, pretty amazing. I always thought I'd get back sooner than I did, but I had a good time. You know, we had a good time together in Barcelona.
Yeah.
And it was good to just be able to relax as opposed to like you have to be here and do this sound check and then wait 5 hours to play and all that.
We had a lot of like small things planned and everything, but not anything that took up so much. Like we weren't going everywhere all the time, every single day planned out.
Right.
We kind of took it a little easy and relaxed a little bit so that way we can explore different places.
I'm not sure I know how to do that. Relax or take time out or...
It's taken me a lot to get to that point. I used to be so like, oh, I have to go all the time. But at the pandemic and having a surgery right around in the pandemic times and stuff really made it to where I had to slow down. Mm-hmm. And whenever I allowed myself to relax and give myself the grace to be able to relax, then I've had a much better time with it. Now I'm all like, yeah, you know what? That thing can wait.
I think I need drugs.
Don't we all?
No, I mean like right now. It's a theme. It seems to be a theme every week that we do this. I apologize.
No, there's definitely guilt associated with like slowing down, you know.
Oh, this culture is definitely bad about that.
Well, I'm kind of hyper though.
Yeah.
I'm self-employed and it suits my hyperness because I'm constantly having to do something to make money or, you know, lead to something that might pay the bills. So it suits my nature.
Mm-hmm.
But it's hard to turn that off. If you're writing songs, does that take a, okay, I got to write this in 2 or 3 minutes?
You know, it's weird because I've learned that every song's different. Some songs definitely don't take that long. You know, maybe 15 minutes or half an hour. It just comes to you and you bash it out. And then sometimes you're holding on to an idea or a riff or some kind of content for weeks, months, years. I mean, so absolutely. But I mean, every song is different. I kind of believe that the song tells you what to do, what you should do. Certain ones are like, you need to finish me right now. And other ones are like, you know, take your time because you don't have this yet, you know. But they'll tell you whether you need a bridge in that song, whether you need a solo or not or whatever. I had started working with Graham Burks on this solo record, which eventually became Bear Grease. And I'd go over to his house. We did the record in his back house and whatnot. And there were certain things that I knew I was going to be showing him. I remember one day I had a song that I knew I was kind of, I think I was a little shaky on it. So I wasn't all that excited. And then I don't know what it was. I remember having the idea in my car is that the idea for Your Ice Cream Is Gonna Melt One Day was, you know, just came to me. And that's a song that I had to finish. And I finished it that day. And I went to him and we recorded the basic tracks that night. That very, very rarely happens.
As you may.
don't write 6 minute songs, do you?
There's a 6 minute song on Bear Grease.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, okay. It's called Patron of the Arts, and it goes
very, very long.
And it goes on about as long as you want it to, and even longer than that, really.
Okay. But,
the ice cream song was taken from a line that you had said to me, and you're like, I'm going to use that. And
we were in
the kitchen dishing out some ice cream, and you were like, oh, here, your ice cream is gonna melt.
Eat it, you know, because you're letting it go. But like, I like the idea of one day. It's like, duh, you know, ice cream, if you leave it out, will melt in a matter, you know,
in my fridge it
hour
melts
or more. Yeah.
That's a whole other problem. Well, Harlan Ellison would, you know, come up with a title, then he'd write the story.
If I have a decent title, then I will try like hell to make that work. I'll give you an example that I'm still working on. This will just give you an example.
Are we going to cut to the example? No.
No. It'd be funny if we did. You'll understand why here in a minute. Just how ridiculous I am about this. So when I was in college, which was back between the Paleolithic and Mesozoic eras, so I was in a band back at that point, and we were going to record like an album or whatever.
What was the band?
You know, three guys that were based at Rutgers College. Funnily enough, the band was called Sponge. And this was before the band from Detroit, the grunge band, broke. But by that point, I think we'd probably already broken up or not playing together or whatever. Anyway, we're at this guy's house who's going to record this album that we want to do. And he's trying to sell us on his talent and his abilities. So he's got, and because this is as far back as it was, got a bunch of cassette tapes, and he'll pop one in after the other just for us to listen to. And he's like, check this one out. You guys will like this. So it's a song, and he told us that the name of the song was She's Having Sex in the Pet Store Window. And I was like, that's brilliant. And then he put it on and pressed play, and I was just so disappointed, because I'm like, you had such great ammunition.
Build it up.
You had a fantastic title. And then this, I don't know what this shit is. I'm listening. So I was like, you know, I swear it's my mission to write a song, a good song, and call it She's Having Sex in the Pet Store Window. And the point being with that is that I did come up with like the framework for the song. It's very Jan and Dean like.
Okay.
Harmonies. Kind of a la New Girl in School, something like that.
So right.
Hopefully, yeah. I mean, I don't know who I'm going to get to buy off and actually working on this.
What's your favorite? I mean, you mash up genres, don't you?
Accidentally. Not ever really something conscious. But
was that your first band that you were in, Sponge?
It was, because I was a late bloomer. Okay. So like I started playing music. I took clarinet lessons, and I guess I was about 10. Mm. Clarinet and then sax, which I think is, Lauren, that's the same trajectory. That
really? I actually played clarinet in the high school bands and through middle school, too, actually.
But y'all didn't know each other then?
No. I grew up in southern Indiana, and he grew up in New Jersey.
So I was taking classes. I learned how to read music and everything. I was in the school. I didn't take guitar lessons until I was 13 or so. I didn't immediately jump into trying to be in a band or play with other people. That took a while, because I was kind of shy. I was probably a little intimidated and whatever. Where I went to high school, there was like one band that I can recall ever having seen, you know, playing like a party or whatever.
Original music even?
I think there were a couple originals interspersed, but it was mostly covers. It was Morristown High School. So in Morristown, New Jersey, it's in South Jersey near Cherry Hill. It's not too far from Philadelphia. Years ago, CNN came out with one of those lists like they do every year, like top places to live in the U.S.
That's like Jasper is on that list.
Yeah, Morristown one year was number one. It's really weird, because it is kind of like,
and Memphis was not.
it's like a Mayberry type.
Yeah,
that's kind of like where, you know, I grew up too, and in southern Indiana. It's very small, very like, I didn't even grow up in the town though. I grew up outside of the town.
Yeah,
and everything. He's seen where I
did. You grow up on gravel or pavement?
Gravel.
Me too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Growing up in that area, I developed a kind of complicated relationship with the music of Bruce Springsteen. In that it was, and this is a similar thing to you with Mellencamp.
John Cougar Mellencamp.
Oh, there you go. Oh, yeah. You guys are Americana sweethearts.
Oh, there we go. Yeah. Little pink house. You get a little pink house. You get a little pink house. And then also right about the time I am 13 is when Born in the USA came out. So if you thought the Springsteen worship was over the top before, now it's just like he's the biggest thing going aside from Michael Jackson or in Prince, you know.
Wait, so you were 13 in 83, 84?
84. Mm-hmm. 12, 13 years old. There was a classic rock station, or AOR, I guess they call it, in Philly that like Quitting Time every Friday. I don't remember if it was 4 or 5 o'clock, but every Friday they would play Rosalita. Every freaking Friday. I mean, that's the extent to which it got forced down your throat.
Dennis, old you want to cue that
rock
up?
And roll.
And, you know,
they play old time rock and roll every Friday morning on my bus ride and stuff on the station that everybody listened to, 96 WSTO. And they had somebody announce it's Friday. And
you, like, as you were leaving your gravel road.
But it was a, like Bob Seger, old time rock and roll. And it's like,
oh God, I hate that song too.
Torture.
I like Seger. I like Seeger's early stuff pretty well, and I don't begrudge him anything, but I've always hated that song.
Right.
Oh, it's like one of a few songs where you will, if you're on the radio, remember what that is, radio, you know, and like, say you're listening, you know, like when Rock 103 days or whatever, you know, it's about three songs that I would absolutely change the channel on. And one of them, you hear that piano at the beginning, twitch. And then the other one that I can remember offhand is American Pie. It's like, long, long time ago, I'm not hearing your ass anymore because your song is 18 minutes.
So have you been on the radio in Jersey now?
I went to Rutgers, but I was friends with people who were affiliated with the station who maybe had shows, but I never had my own show.
Oh, like hosting a show.
I might be forgetting, but I can't remember an instance offhand.
Do you tour up there?
The short answer is that we basically played New Jersey and New York, mm-hmm. and went into Philly. We did not go, I mean, we could have gone to a place like Boston or whatever, mm-hmm. but it's about a 5-hour drive. But for some reason, 5 hours seemed like a longer drive there and then than it does here and now, just because sometimes you have to drive to go to shows, plus having, you know, done a fair amount of touring or whatever, you kind of get used, you're a little more open to the idea than you would have been if you hadn't done it before and you're, you know, 20 years old. And like,
I was interviewing Seth Moody a while back with Graham, and he was talking about all the places he had lived and how he thought he was playing music that he liked, but then when he got here, he had a transcendental moment.
Yeah.
And is that something similar to you, or how did you get here and how did you start assimilating into what you would become with Memphis Bands?
I had gone to South by Southwest in 97. It was kind of like a result of hanging out in an AOL folder. Again, if you remember that, it's gone the way of radio, I guess.
AOR and AOL.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. Quick-minded. That's what I like about you. So
I was at Southwest in 97.
Oh, yeah.
Was during Sore Losers, and Guitar Wolf was there. And
I saw Guitar Wolf at Waterloo.
Yeah.
They did an in-store at the record store. Yeah, yeah. I was there for that.
Yeah.
That's the first time I saw Guitar Wolf. And one of those things where the first time you see a band like that, you're like, you know, wow, what's this?
Are they from Memphis?
Yeah. Right. I didn't even know there was a Memphis connection.
Oh, right.
I met someone who is from here the next year. And we started dating long distance. And I moved down in 99.
She who shall not be named.
Well, you know, Vanessa.
Okay, good enough.
And we broke up right about the time I moved down. Mm. But so I was trying to get my bearing. I lined up a job that wasn't that wonderful. But I really wanted to start playing. And this, at this point being 99. So what you had was the Memphis Flyer. And they had the classifieds. And I figured I would see if anybody wanted to start something up. So I put an ad out, and I can't remember the exact wording. I got, I want to say somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 calls.
Dang.
From different people. There was this one guy who called me, and he was calling me from a hotel, from a room in the Admiral Benbow. Yeah, man, I want to blah, 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 and check this out. Here's a riff. So he had like one of those little crate amps. Apparently he was sitting on it, and he put the receiver down to the amp and then play me a riff. Like, you know, what'd you think of that? here's another one.
Bimbo is impressive enough. Admiral Bimbo.
No kidding.
Yeah, really.
Oh my gosh.
It's just a funny story, but that was a lot of just kind of, I don't know, people was like, did you read the ad? You know, one guy's like, we play blues on Beale and we're looking for an Eric Clapton type player. And I'm like, yeah.
That was just what you wanted to sign up for, wasn't it?
Yeah. But almost all of them were bad. there were two that were worth anything at all. One was Johnny Norris, who was looking at that time for a lead guitar player for Crash Into June, and Greg Robertson, who did not tell me at that time that he had started playing with Greg Cartwright.
Okay.
But he was like, hey, you know, why don't you come over and hang? We can try writing some stuff and you know, whatever. So went over there and I remember thinking, yeah, this is an interesting character. Should stay in touch with him. And
no, wait. So you went over to Greg's house,
uh-huh.
But it was just you and him.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you were interested in playing bass though, right?
That didn't happen yet because mm-hmm. I hadn't really played bass seriously. I think there was one or two gigs maybe where I ventured into that scenario, but not quite, I'd say a month after I first talked to Robertson, he called me back and he told me that he was working with Cartwright and did I know who the Oblivions were and the Compulsive Gamblers. And by that point, yeah, I did know. But I wasn't as familiar as I was going to be. But anyway, the two of them had started working together, and then they were playing a bit with Tim Prudhomme. The three of them had a rehearsal spot toward U of M. And Greg was like, well, the thing is that Cartwright and Tim both play guitar. You know, when's the last time you had a bass in your hand? And I'm like, well, it's been a minute, but sure, I could do it. And it's like, well, we're going to meet at such and such a time, and here's the address and whatever. And it turned out that Tim had a bass that I could borrow. So we just we played through some things that Greg had written, like I Don't Care If You Ever Come Back and stuff like that. Some things that wound up on the first record, and then some that didn't, and a couple covers, and it was fun. And it just kind of went from there.
When you try to tell a lie, you look down into your shoes. I could learn to read your face, but I've already heard the news. People love to talk when it's sure to bring
to see.
I guess.
Well, I think you were.
It took a while for us because Robertson hadn't been playing drums regularly. I wasn't a bass player. This was new material to Cartwright. And then we had Tim kind of was doing his own thing. So he kind of gradually fell out of the picture. But he did play a gig with us. He wore a green marching band uniform.
Yes.
Which is, you know, that's Tim for you. But Tim needed to do his own thing. So we had Melissa Dunn play with us once or twice, and did some gigs until I think like Alex had been back in town, but I guess they approached him, and then we did like a gig or two with Alex, and Alex learned a lot of stuff very quickly because before I knew it, we were in the studio recording.
Alex Green,
recording Breakup Breakdown. So.
So you're suddenly, I say suddenly, but immersed in the Midtown rock and roll scene, but you had already formed your musical opinions and what you liked and what you didn't like before you even got to Memphis.
I did, before I moved down here, I was an R&B fan and everything. And growing up, I listened to a lot of radio, but not necessarily or not just the AOR stations. I listened to a lot of oldies. Mm-hmm. And at that point, oldies radio, and we're talking 82, 3, 4 throughout, was not as, the playlists were not nearly as narrow as they are now. Now, you know, it's a computer with 200 songs, but mm-hmm. there was a lot of oddball stuff that you would hear that you have no hope in hell of hearing on the airwaves now for the most part. Certainly not on commercial radio. But got to hear a lot of R&B and a lot of doo-wop also, and that I was a fan of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I had knowledge. I wasn't exactly, you know, I didn't know all these deep cuts or anything. But, you know, the good thing about coming and playing with people here and being exposed to a lot of stuff is just that it's coming at you from all angles.
Yeah.
Yeah, moving to Memphis was really an education in music for me, especially because, I grew up out in the middle of nowhere, Indiana, very white bread, no R&B, no soul music, really. It was just all really, really boring, bland, either classic rock, but not that deep of cuts, or pop music. There's always new stuff out there to find.
But even like with the people that might be considered more mass or mainstream, even like Elvis or Bowie or people like that, it's like there's always something interesting. Like I've been listening to Bowie's Pinups album and then realizing I need to listen to The Who more, and then why is that? And, you know, going it down those kind of avenues.
Yeah.
But that kind of gets into your interest of going into Weevil. Mm-hmm. How did your DJ spot on Weevil come out? I assume it came on the heels of playing with Raining Sound, or?
It really didn't. It was kind of a separate thing. I started listening to Weevil, stumbled upon the station, and enjoyed several of the programs. And one of the programs that I did enjoy was this one that was on Wednesday morning called Janet's Planet, which was Janet Wilson's show at the time. So I went and messaged her about something she played. We started talking. She actually did come see Raining Sound, and that's where we met and talked about stuff, and then kept in touch. And then one day she was like, you know, you really ought to apply to the station, you know, to be an on-air volunteer. It seems like you know a fair amount about music, and you probably have a good show that you could do. So I went down there and spoke with Brian, the program director, Brian Craig, for a while. And within a few months had a show, and that was spring of 2002.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's fun. I just remember listening to your show, and sometimes you just find things by accident or you're free at a certain point in the day. And you were playing stuff that was very intriguing and interesting to me, and I didn't know anything really about the bands you were playing, but I could tell that I was in love with those bands.
Oh,
you know, I remember one morning you during the pledge drives with you and Bifus. I gave some little pittance of money to the station, and you gave a shout out to my dad. who passed away like a little bit later after that, and I always like think back on that.
Aww.
So that was cool. That's cool. So I appreciate you doing that.
Oh, no problem.
Yeah,
it's interesting every week because it's a two-hour framework, and there's a lot of different things that I like playing, and every week is going to be a little different because I might want to focus, or it's not even like, hey, now I'm going to play more R&B this week, or I'm going to play more, punk rock or whatever. But it just kind of flows. It's like, well, I haven't played that in a while. Let's try this, and here's this new stuff that I like, and whatever. So there's a certain ebb and flow of the show.
Tribute shows sometimes.
Yeah, and sometimes there's a tribute thing. I do a Gene Clark tribute every year because he's my favorite songwriter. Actually, I lumped that in with Doug Somm because they both. They both had birthdays in the month of November. So
okay,
yeah.
You go from playing in bands to doing your own thing.
Yeah,
and then you're playing all these songs in a radio program.
Mm.
It's all congealing and becoming your own style, and you're taking influences from here and there. How does that work for you?
A lot of it works on a subconscious level.
Sure.
There are certain people that I could tell you that I feel are influences, but I don't know that you could necessarily hear them in what I'm doing. Although I'm like, well, I can hear them, but not just Gene Clark, but somebody like Tommy Keane or something like that. It's just really kind of subliminal, you know. It's just you hear stuff for long enough, and then there's you subconsciously, you know, maybe not take something wholesale, but there might be something in there that triggers something.
Would this be a cool moment to play a Gene Clark song, or what would you want to play from an influence?
That works. Gene Clark song.
Yeah, what would be your favorite Gene Clark song to play?
I think the song that I like, it's a Bird song called "The World Turns All Around Her."
She's everything you could want, and if you think she's everything that could be, well, I still think the world turns all around her, and I still wish that she belonged to me. I don't know how I ever could have thought that I'd let her go and still be just the same, but I found out my world turned all around her, and everywhere I go I hear her name. Somewhere along the way, I don't know why, but now whenever I see her with you, I realize how much I didn't know. So if you tell her every day you love her, and if you tell her everything she could be, you'll find out that your world will turn around her. You'll feel the same if you should set her free.
Toy Trucks is still together.
We are, I would never say never to anything, but what happened was in the latter days of the band, I started playing with Graham and doing these songs that I thought were wound up on the solo record that I thought were going to be more, I thought was going to be more acoustic, a lot more acoustic than that album wound up being. Aww. But the two of us were working on stuff, and then
Steve moved.
Yeah, and Steve moved. He, he moved to New Orleans. Yeah. And he's now in Colorado. Graham and I got Mitchell Manley involved, and that was really a catalyst because it was like, okay, this is a three-piece, but I really want a second guitar player, but it feels like a band, and it feels like we could really we have a shot at executing this stuff live. And I'm really digging these songs. So, and it was a different set of songs than mm-hmm. the Toy Truck sets were. And then I just wrote some more stuff to go with that. And then we brought Noel Clark in, and then I was like, I'm really having a lot of fun with this band, and I should just, you know.
So how many bands are you no longer in?
Oh, shit. 11 billion in
years. Yes.
I'll leave that
never
up to
mentioned
you.
The ones, yeah.
Subtractions. But,
yeah.
And there's like Fresh Flesh.
The Subtractions.
Oh, yeah. And, yes, and the Subtractions. How could I forget? So,
oh, my God.
So Steve Barnett, who was in Toy Trucks with me, and Alex Green, and I, and Mike Michaud, did the Subtractions band for a while, which was pretty much like a 60s rock and R&B cover band sort of thing. Oh, yeah. So previous to that, I had been in Jeffrey and the Pacemakers.
And Dan Montgomery's band,
And
too.
I played with Dan Montgomery for probably about 5 years.
So if we're going to play some songs from these bands, what would we play?
Oh, all right. On the spot. Well, Subtractions don't have anything recorded because it was like basically all cover material.
You guys played the Time Warp Drive-In. That was fantastic.
Yeah. See, I remember that. Yeah, it was like 10 years ago. It popped up in my Facebook. This is the sort of thing we're talking about. Where's this shit going?
Count Basil introduced you.
Yeah. Man, that was a fun time. Wasn't there the baptisms in the kiddie pool with the popcorn?
We did baptisms by popcorn.
Yes.
Yeah. Were you in and on that?
I did not do that personally, but I watched it.
I wish you had.
We'll have to do another one, and then this time, yeah, I'll wear stuff I don't care about.
Me and James Lloyd were getting really good at it, like holding people under the popcorn just to the point where they couldn't breathe anymore. Then we'd bring them back. All right, so you can't play Subtraction. I love the way it's like you were in these bands, but you don't have any recordings.
A lot of things were unrecorded or under-recorded. I feel like those two albums I told you about before, I feel like eventually one way or another I'll have them out. But, you know, it's not like anybody's begging me to put them out right now.
Right.
So it's okay. I can concentrate on other stuff, but I think it will happen.
So what about the Pacemakers? Tell me something we can play. Pacemakers? Or?
All right. Play with Dan Montgomery, who Dan is also from New Jersey.
Dan's got some stuff recorded.
And yeah, Dan's got
Dan's got
a bunch of records. I was on two albums and an EP.
You should tell him about the small world of Dan growing up
This is good. So Weevil used to have a potluck party at Ernestine and Hazel's like every holiday season. And the first year that I was there, I went to that first year being involved with the station. I went to the party and Judy goes, there's this guy here. He's from your neck of the woods and he loves your show and you should talk to him. I'm like, okay. So I went over and introduced myself to Dan. And I could tell talking with Dan had a very strong New Jersey accent, specifically South Jersey. And I said, so Dan, where are you from? He said, New Jersey. And I said, yeah, I know. Where in New Jersey? And he said, Pensauken. I said, that's where my dad's company was. And his eyes got real narrow. And he was like, what was your dad's company? And I said, I told him it was across the street from Pensauken High School. And Dan and his buddies used to go down the way to get alcohol underage because it was very easy to do that at that time in that area. And they'd go into the after hours into the parking lot of my dad's company and they'd drink beer in the parking lot. And I told my father this and he was like, so that's where all those bottles came from. He thought it was funny. That's the definition of small world right there.
Well, that's a setup for the song for sure.
All right. So yeah, there's a song. You should play this song. It's a fun one. It's off of an album of his called Sin, Repent, Repeat. And, it's called Crack Home. And the full title is, it's not a crack house, it's a crack home.
I might be crack house, it's a crack home.
Yeah. See, wasn't that a thing of beauty? You know, that was just...
Those are the kind of stories that I live for.
And we did that at Scott Bomar's studio.
Electrophonic.
And I was actually sitting across from Robert Mache when he played the guitar solo. Mm-hmm. And
he was
the best, wow. Man. The absolute best. And he was tearing into that mother. It was unbelievable. And you could hear it on that take there. But... yeah, unbelievable guitar.
How many bands do you play or have you played in at the same time in that Memphis way?
Oh God, yeah. Oh, are we going to get into this?
Well, I'm just looking for more song setups, but you know.
All right. There was a time when I was in five bands.
Yeah.
Not all of them played like every week or even every month. Whatever, and that was during the time I was playing with Harlan. So Harlan was probably the biggest, you know, because those shows were events, man. The old High Tone, and you know, other places too, but those are the ones I remember the most.
Were those the Monday night shows?
Did we do that?
You had a regular gig, right?
We did. Yeah. I think early on we did a Monday night. Wow, I didn't remember that. And then we did the $5 cover taping too. That was pretty cool.
Oh,
we
Lord.
Did that there.
Well, I was there for that.
Oh God, that was how they had to turn the AC off in between to kick it on and off, you know, between takes and whatever.
We should play a Harlan tune.
We should. How about we play? Well, this is the favorite that everybody had back in the day. I don't know whether this would pass muster now, but it's all right. It's called Left Your Door Unlocked.
You left your door unlocked. Couldn't keep from coming in. Though I could, stayed outside. It was raining and I knew you were out with him. Just to lie in our bed. I only stay here a while. I make believe that you and me are here at home. I always lie this place. It's the kind of place that feels at home. I guess I'd hope to find some little thing that proves you to think I'm me. Just to lie in our bed. Just to see that things have changed. I only stay here a while. I make believe that you and me are here at home. There's somewhere getting drunk. When you get back home, you find me sleeping, and you know how much I care. Just to lie in our bed. I only stay here a while. I make believe that you and me are here at home.
Thank you.
We're not running out of bands yet, are we?
No, I mean, we should talk a little bit more about the current one.
Go for
in
it.
In fact, the Drip Edges band, which came out of the solo record, the Bear Grease record, because Graham and I, basically what we did was we reversed engineered a band, because on the solo record, 99% of it is just me and Graham Burks, where we brought Mitchell in and then later Noel, as I mentioned earlier, and then just got tighter, and the songs got a little louder and everything, started really enjoying playing rock and roll again, and that's kind of where we are now. We are currently mixing a 6-song EP that I'm hoping will be out within the next couple months or so. So that's, you know, those are all I've been listening to rough mixes, including, I think, one that might be a final mix, the last few days or so, and just everybody really stepped up and did a great job on their respective instruments.
So some, the two bands you mentioned have the same members or variations.
The solo record was just me and Graham, and the way we do it is just we do a basic track with me usually on acoustic and Graham on drums, and then I'd overdub bass and some guitars. He might overdub like some percussion or like a mellotron on this song, or I think there's an ebow on one. This esoteric stuff that I wouldn't ever think of, but winds up sounding really good.
Right.
Yeah.
Was it because of COVID? You guys were just working?
This was actually pre-COVID that we were working on this, because concurrently I was preparing the Toy Trucks record to come out, and of course COVID hit 6 months after that happened. So I think a lot of people who were putting out albums around that time wound up feeling like they were blindsided a little bit.
Right. How long did you and Graham work on a song, or maybe this is just a general question to you, how long do you work on a song before you feel like A, I can play it live, or B, I can record it?
Well, it was a little different for the solo stuff, just because I'd been doing like maybe some solo acoustic shows here and there, and that would be my way of kind of like getting familiar with the songs. But there wasn't a band like in the usually you want to, like back in the Raining Sound days, we used to go and play a bunch live and play some new stuff and then really get that stuff tight, and then you go into the studio and it's semi-second nature or whatever. Whereas this case, in this scenario, I was bringing the songs in. I didn't even demo them. I went over to Graham's house. I picked up a guitar and I said, literally, it was like, this is this one. This is how it goes. And he'd say, play it again. I'd play it a second time. Maybe he'd want it a third time. Then he'd get behind the drums and we'd play through the song once to see if we could do it without any mistakes. And then like, maybe a second time, and then record it. So, and I don't think there's a song on there that has any more than like 2 or 3 takes. Oh. You know, so he picked up on stuff really quickly. That's a testament to his ability to really grasp intuitively what was going on.
And this is the upstairs Garage Out Back studio?
He moved like a couple miles west not long afterward. This is when he still lived
Poplar.
A little closer, yeah. So that was a little different. The way we handle things in the band now is I like to really kind of test stuff out live or get used to playing it live, so that, you know, the parts don't have to be solidified, but just kind of know how the song goes. We know how the song ends. I've been in a situation before where not everybody in the band knew that the song was going to end, because it hadn't been worked out before. There's a song like that on Break Up, Break Down. See if you can figure out which one it is. Two guys stopped, two guys kept going, you know, and we faded it out, you know, and love it. You know, that was the thing about the last Raining Sound record, is that we did really well with it. You know, everybody did a great job, but we were at a disadvantage compared to previous, because we were coming in, we didn't have the benefit of playing these shows where we could debut these songs and work on them in a live setting. So it was kind of like, it felt a little bit more like cramming for an exam, just because the songs were still kind of being written in a few cases up to the last minute. So it was a little bit of a different experience,
but you know, spontaneous.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you don't really want to know it too well. Mm-mm. You know, just enough to get by, just enough to be able to fudge stuff and make it, you know, sound like it's, you know, once you kind of know where it's like, this is the part I'm going to play every single time. I mean, there are instances where, hey, that's the riff and you got to do that. But, you know, you want to allow yourself a little bit of an opportunity to be spontaneous. Well, it's just a matter of doing it for so long. And then in that case, playing with people that, you know, you kind of fall back into what you were doing, but we were, you know, trying to do it a little different. So that was kind of like the extra layer to it. But generally speaking, yeah, it's like these people you knew from 20 years ago or more, and, you know, and you've still been friendly through the years, and it's fine.
Well, so you said that you were bringing a song over that was it experimental, or is it already done? It's like the new song?
It's a new song, and it is, I think we have basically a final mix on it.
And which band is this?
This is the Drip Edges.
The Drip Edges, okay.
Yeah.
What? Okay, tell us a little bit about this, and we'll play it.
All right. Yeah, why don't we debut it? What the hell, man? All right.
If that's okay.
There's no rules. What the hell? No, so the song is called Everything's Gonna Have to Be All Right. And it's like an up-tempo anthem sort of thing. It's just basically the message being is that nothing's ever really optimal. We know that now. The last 8 years, we know things have been like a far shade from optimal. But, you know, you just keep on trucking, man. You do what you can.
So you're saying the Drip Edges album will be out in maybe the fall of 2024?
Yeah, it's going to be six songs. It's about 19 or 20 minutes because that's what people's, you know, that's what all our attention spans can muster at the moment. But I felt like those songs just all really were of a piece and went together. What I'm currently doing is writing for a full length beyond that.
Yeah.
And that stuff's coming along. I'm going to be demoing some stuff hopefully next week. And really looking forward to bringing some of those new songs in and playing them live and working on them.
At Graham's house?
Or, yeah. In all probability, yeah. But this EP, I'm hoping within the next couple months, it just depends on the schedule for the remainder of the mixing and mastering and whatever admin stuff I got to do to make that happen.
Well, when you write lyrics, do you... I know you're trying to are you trying to be like political, metaphorical? You just want to have fun. You don't want to talk too much about reality. What?
There, every once in a while, there will be a song that takes a little bit of a political or a socio-political slant. I think Everything's Gonna Have to Be All Right is kind of like that.
Right.
There's at least one other on the new one that I can think of. But there's no real hard and fast rule.
What's your favorite Birds album?
As much as I love Gene Clark, the first five are incredible. But I kind of have to give it to Notorious Bird Brothers.
Hmm.
Because the whole thing's great, but side one is just... it flows so amazingly. It's phenomenal. The production is amazing. The vocals are just stellar. It's got a certain vibe to it. Very kind of like pop art, very psychedelic in a way that I don't think they quite got. They certainly didn't after that.
Mm-hmm.
It's that whole time frame right after Gene left from 8 Miles High through that record. It's just amazing shit.
So, what are you listening to right now?
Well, actually, this is a guy that we're going to see another show in October. There's a guy I've gotten into named Theo Lawrence, mm-hmm. who is, I think he's only about 30. He's from France. I think he may have relocated to the Austin area. And he plays like straight up country. And you wouldn't necessarily
absolutely
tell.
Absolutely wonderful.
There's only trace hints of just him being French. You know, you wouldn't listen. If you were listening casually, you wouldn't really pick up on it. The first song on the album that I heard from him, it's like total 1968 Bakersfield.
Yes.
Super
excited to hear him play. So,
yeah,
we're going to go down to Oxford.
I'm sure he's good live, yeah. He's going to be playing
as close
Proud
as Oxford.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Proud Larry's at sometime in October.
But no Memphis connection. I mean, no place to play.
Yeah, I know.
I mean,
yeah.
It'd be good to probably play at Hernando's. It's that kind of vibe.
That'd be
a great place for him.
Book him while you're down
there. Yeah, I will mention it. That would be perfect.
You're having these shows. You're having fun. You're doing things together as a couple. You're happily married.
Yep.
And everything's going great. You're going to have a record coming out.
Yeah.
If we go out on a song, what would it be?
Let's go out with another one from the Toy Trucks record. It is a song called Captain Remo. And it's basically, you talk about different topics for different songs. That one's basically sort of about the creative process and how there's always kind of like stuff going on that you have to connect with artistically, no matter how you're feeling, you know, you could be just really down. You could just feel like, you know, exhausted, like you're going to fall through your ass and hang yourself. But then, you got to connect, make an effort to connect with the creative forces to come up with stuff, because that's what you do, right? You know, if you're a creative, there's always something to tap into. There's a certain rhythm, I guess, that you can always plug into.
Everywhere, Captain Remo, he don't care, he's banging on a busted stand.
Thank y'all for being here, and I appreciate it. And I think we talked about everything. I feel like we should have played more songs even. So if we keep talking long enough here, we could still go out on another song. Thank y'all.
Good.